Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. Has your cat at home, assuming you've got a cat, ever fainted? Does your horse look rather sad at times? For that matter, is any other animal of your acquaintance somehow burdened by one or another kind of psychological problem, physical problem? Of course, that happens all the time. That's what veterinarians are there to attend to. But veterinarians know a great deal about disease that allopathic doctors who treat human beings may not know, and perhaps vice versa. The fact is, we are very much like our animal neighbors in our pathologies. And we're going to be talking about that tonight with the authors of a fascinating new book titled Zoobiquity. That neologism needs to be explained and will be shortly. But the subtitle is What Animals Can Teach Us About Health and the Science of Healing. The authors are Barbara Madison Horowitz, who is a physician, indeed a cardiologist, and Catherine Bowers, who is a veteran science writer. On to a conversation with the team of Madison Horowitz and Bowers. That sounds like three people, but it's only two. After we pause for the update on the evening's news from Paula Cooper.
It's Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg from the Allstate Studios in Chicago on 720 WGN.
And as I did foretell you, our guests tonight are Catherine Bowers and Barbara Natterson Horowitz. Together, they are the authors of a wonderful new book titled Zoobiquity, What Animals Can Teach Us About Health and the Science of Healing. I'd like to start where I can with a classical reference, or at least with a bit of poetry or doggerel. So I offer you these lines. Great Caesar's bust is on the shelf, and I don't feel so good myself. That's a way of saying, affirming that death happens, Caesar is gone, but also that disease comes before death, one way or another. Reading your book, I learned that Great Caesar's bust is on the shelf, and I don't feel so good myself, is relevant to all human beings, and really to just about all other animal species, maybe to botanical ones as well. Of course, when you get as far down as the ants, one gets a sense that you're in a different ballgame. But when it comes to the great fish of the sea, and certainly when it comes to the mammals on the land, they are really quite like us, aren't they?
Absolutely.
In their diseases, I mean.
Yes, absolutely. I'm a human physician and practiced medicine for over 20 years. And until I started consulting at the Los Angeles Zoo, I didn't realize that, yes, animals and humans share most of the same diseases. What are the big diseases that affect human beings? Well, breast cancer, diabetes, many other disorders.
Hypertension.
And
heart failure.
And it, absolutely.
And cancer.
It turns out that veterinarians take care of patients with those problems too. Cocker spaniels with breast cancer, miniature ponies with diabetes, even sexually transmitted diseases. There's actually an epidemic of chlamydia affecting the koalas of Australia.
But I learned also that something we've known a good deal in recent years, or we've had verification of in recent years in research concerning the onset of heart failure or of heart disease, is that it's very often prompted by or quickened along the road by stress and by other kinds of psychological trauma. And apparently the very same is demonstrably true of some of our other animal friends.
Yes, there is a form of acute heart failure that can be triggered by stress, fear, someone loses their life savings with the roll of a dice, or someone gets, they have severe trauma and they suddenly mm-hmm. have heart failure. Well, I was at the Los Angeles Zoo one day and I was about to do an ultrasound on a tamarin. Tamarin are these really cute, small Central American monkeys. And as they were sedating the monkey for the procedure, I was looking deeply into her eyes. And at that moment, the veterinarian put his hand on my shoulder and said, "Stop looking into her eyes. You're going to give her capture myopathy." Anyway, one thing led to another, and I learned that just as we humans can have a stress-induced form of heart failure, so too can animals, and not just monkeys. It turns out also shorebirds in Alaska and hoofed animals, okapi and zebras. And that was the beginning of this whole exciting journey to learn about the
Why would a tamarind be affected negatively while you're looking with interest and maybe even with affection into its eyes?
Oh, well, it's so interesting because eye gaze can mean a lot of different things to different species. Mm-hmm. It can be bonding. It can be seductive. And it can also be menacing. And in the case of Barbara looking at the eyes of this tamarin monkey, she wasn't saying, I'm here for you. I'm here to help you. You're so cute. The way she might to a human patient, especially a child. Her eye gaze was actually saying, you look delicious. I'm hungry. I want to eat you.
Hmm. You speak of captive myopathy, define myopathy.
Right, capture myopathy. So myopathy is a disease of the muscle, and there's lots of myopathies in human medicine. But capture myopathy is a disorder that veterinarians have been talking about and writing about for decades. It's an animal who, when terrified, when they've been chased, for example, or perhaps restrained in a pre-predation moment, have a surge of adrenaline that can poison the muscles of their body and sometimes the heart muscle and sometimes lead to acute heart failure.
I have a friend, an academic, as I was for most of my waking years, who was in a faculty meeting where something very important was at issue. He had a large stake in it. He thought he had colleagues who would support him. At the crucial moment of truth, they did not. And his departmental enemy prevailed on this, to him, important issue. Of course, we know the great maxim that the reason that academics fight so hard is because the stakes are so small. It may well be that this wasn't something worth getting excited about, but to him it meant everything. And 3 days later, he had a heart attack.
One of the most fascinating things we discovered in writing Zubiquity is that this acute form of stress-induced heart failure in humans was identified around the year 2000. A big fanfare was made about it in the human cardiology journals. It turns out veterinarians have known about this and have been writing about it in their journal for decades. It's just that veterinarians and physicians so rarely collaborate and communicate, we didn't know about this.
There are wonderful paradoxes and strange mysteries that one discovers in your book. And I should say instantly, it's very well written and has great narrative sections. You go on adventures, the two of you, and they're most interesting adventures. But one very strange puzzle. You make the point that the longer you live and the larger you are, the more likely you're going to develop cancer. And the largest available mammal, though it's a mammal of the sea, and the longest lived is the whale. How do they manage to live so long is the question you raise. They should be getting cancer and dying sooner. Why don't they?
Right. Well, just to kind of just clarify what I think your question is, given that cancer happens when cells divide.
Yeah.
And when every time a cell divides, there's a chance of
mutation.
And
the more cells you've got, the more there's the chance of cancer.
Yeah. As you're saying, that the extremely large animals would, if that was always the case, have the greatest rates of cancer. It turns out, apparently, some of the largest animals on Earth do not seem to have a very high rate of cancer. And there was a scientist named Sir Richard Peto. And so he had this thing called Peto's paradox. Why do these large animals not seem to have much cancer? And it's a very interesting and I think relevant question for physicians and human patients with cancer to ask. What is that?
And do we have an answer to Peto's paradox?
We're only beginning to explore why that happens. And part of the problem has been human medicine has been so separate from animal biology, wildlife biology, and veterinary medicine, we haven't even known to ask those questions.
So it remains a mystery.
There are people that are looking at it now, actually. There's some interesting research about why
it might
be. How
does that parallel, or does it parallel, the differences between human beings? There are some very big humans around, and there are some rather small ones. And more people in between. I was a mere 6'1". I'm shrinking with age, of course. My son is 6'6". Mm. Does it follow? I don't have cancer, happily, at least as far as I know. Does it follow that my son is less likely to develop cancer than I am?
No. Peto's paradox has to do with comparing different species. So comparing a whale to a mouse, not comparing
so it has
different
no intra-species
exactly,
relevance.
Exactly. Different sized individuals within the same species, not
Yao
the issue.
Yao Ming to Carrie Strug, for example, the very tall basketball player or a very small gymnast. It's not that comparison.
We are due to pause right now, as we shall do now and again, for a quick round of commercials. As you may have been told, in real life, I am or was a psychologist. And psychological disease or psychological distress, very often productive of accompanying physical disorder or in consequence of physical disorder, is very real in human experience. It's also apparently quite significant in the lives of many of our animal neighbors. So let's talk about psychosomatic disease. Let's talk about psychological trauma and how they affect somehow the prospect towards life. Mm-hmm. You've got depressed gorillas in this book, for example. What depresses a gorilla? We'll come to that and related questions after we pause for this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Why would a gorilla, I put the question to Catherine Bowers and Barbara Natterson Horowitz, get depressed? Though I must confess, I used to like going to the primate house at the Lincoln Park Zoo, and the gorillas are quite fascinating to watch. And sometimes some of the male gorillas, the alpha, or maybe the displaced former alpha, seem to sit there, if you project onto him some emotions, seem to sit there in a rather dejected state. But then you tell yourself, oh, no, I'm anthropomorphizing. That has nothing to do with what really goes on in the inner life of a gorilla. But you're saying it does.
Well, it's funny you said you should talk about anthropomorphizing. So many of us were instructed so heavily don't do it. Very unscientific. And very important in a certain way to have that perspective. On the other hand, you can go too far, and that cautionary statement can prevent you from identifying commonalities when they actually do exist.
Mm-hmm.
So we asked in the book, do animals get? And we got to psychiatric syndromes. And we said, do animals get depressed? Do they have, you know, self-injury and addiction, etc.? When it comes to depression, there are naturalists who have identified what seems to be depressed behavior in gorillas, geese, sea lions. Of course, you can't ask a gorilla or a sea lion if they're depressed. But as a psychiatrist, I actually trained as a psychiatrist before I became a cardiologist, I know that a patient can tell you they're depressed, or you can observe their behavior. They may decrease their eating. They may cease to be interested in the activities that gave them pleasure before. They may withdraw. And when you see
that, they either sleep a lot or hardly sleep at all.
Correct. And when you see those kinds of behaviors in animals, one has to ask, gee, is this an instance of depressed mood, etc.? And we want to be careful, and we were very scientifically skeptical in writing the book, and yet we read about these commonalities and we learned about them from experts.
What depresses a gorilla, then?
Well, stress, isolation, and boredom seem to be triggers that veterinarians have identified in animals who have depressed
moods. Former alpha males, once they are displaced by a younger challenger, do they typically get depressed after that?
So there are stories of not just gorillas, but monkeys, for example, who when they have been displaced, there may no longer be a place for them within the group in which they once were the top, the alpha. And they can be banished from groups and in some cases actually cease to stop eating and actually die.
And the thinking is in some cases that that's actually protective behavior for them because it keeps them from engaging in fighting or other activities that might harm them further.
The emotional life of the breeds we know is always a great fascination. And it's something you project onto and you anthropomorphize, I suppose. But if you just think of the differences between cats and dogs, they are two breeds apart. They're both mammals. They're both quadrupeds. Maybe they're about equal in intelligence. But they're totally different in their emotional life, aren't they?
I've heard veterinarians say cats are just weird because they sometimes are the exception to almost every rule you can come up with. But yeah, they're very
different. They're solitaries, basically. They may get interested in other cats, but dogs are fascinated by dogs.
Well, you know, it's interesting also, there are different breeds of dogs that have which are predisposed to different seemingly psychological problems. For example, Shelties and Weimaraners and other dog breeds seem predisposed to anxiety. Dobermann, for example, have a higher incidence of obsessive-compulsive disorder. Many of them are treated with Prozac and drugs like Prozac.
Should they be?
Well, it depends on your perspective on what we should do with behavioral disturbance, I guess, in animals or humans.
Mm-hmm. The Prozac revolution is over, I think, generally, when it comes to psychopharmaceuticals, is it not? I know it's still prescribed, but
I think most or many mainstream psychiatrists still treat patients with a combination of talk therapy, psychopharmaceuticals when appropriate, cognitive behavioral therapies.
What do we learn about the great scourge of diseases? You are a cardiologist, after all. What brings on heart disease in humans? To what degree is the genetic factor primary?
Well, there are many forms of heart disease that affect human beings. Disease of the arteries of the heart, what's called epicardial coronary artery disease, is the main killer of humans.
Atherosclerotic thickening of the arteries. Yeah.
That is not typically the disease that we see in animals with heart disease. For example, there are many dog breeds that have heart failure from a leaky valve, something called mitral valve prolapse.
That's a human affliction
and that's
as well.
Absolutely seen in humans as well. That typically is genetic. There are other heart diseases that affect cats. There's a form, something called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. It's the disease that affects high school athletes. Occasionally, tragically, a high school athlete dies. Very often, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is a diagnosis. That's seen in a number of cat breeds and some dogs as well. And those are genetic disorders.
Essentially, if you have a heart, you can have problems with it.
And sooner or later you do, unless something else goes wrong first.
I would suppose.
One of the surprising things as a human cardiologist that really I had very little awareness of was how similar the hearts just basically looked. Over the course of working at the zoo and helping the vets, I saw the hearts of course, lions and sea lions and many great apes and many monkeys and even some snakes. And seeing the echocardiograms, these are the cardiac ultrasounds, and seeing how nearly identical they were to human hearts was perception-altering for me. On the one hand, I mean, I knew that we evolved, you know, through animals. We were, but to see that a lion's heart, we share a common ancestor with lions maybe 40 to 60 million years ago. And when you look at a lion's heart on an echocardiogram, it's practically indistinguishable from a human four-chambered heart.
And of course, when we compare ourselves to our closest neighbors, the higher apes, the anthropoid apes, the similarities are constantly impressive, are they not?
Yeah, physical and again behaviorally, there are so many interesting similarities. And again, I think in a certain sense, because we share so much of our genetic legacy with, let's say, chimpanzees, it's about 97% to 98%. But even as we go leftward on the evolutionary timeline, as we go back to common ancestors, as we go to other mammals who are not primates, the vast majority of our genetics are still shared with those animals, and we forget that. As physicians, it has not been part of the clinical conversation.
And I think even as patients, we're used to looking at differences, what makes us uniquely human, rather than what connects us to the rest of the animal world.
Carl Sagan once stunned me in a conversation. He was a rather frequent guest on this program in his heyday. As we were talking about our genetic similarity to apes and so on, he said, yes, we're very closely related to apes, but you know, we share half of our genome with bananas. Mm-hmm. Did you know that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, even fruit flies, you know, we're looking at 60%. Yeah. So, yes, we are far more connected than we realize we are. And it's interesting, we tend to think of so many of our problems as unique to us, uniquely human. Very often the really bad things we think of as uniquely humans, many people, many patients we spoke to, many physicians before I wrote this book and I talked to them thought cancer was uniquely human. But even sexual dysfunction, just it never occurred to me that an animal could have sexual dysfunction and so on.
You've got a wonderful chapter in the book about a potentially or partially impotent stallion who is undoubtedly of good breeding stock, and they want to get him engagé with a young female horse,
yes.
But it doesn't work at first.
That's right. We went to visit some horses at a stallion breeding farm and learned a lot while we were there. Mm. This particular horse you're talking about was named Lancelot, and he...
a name of a great lover.
Yes, exactly. And we watched him as they tried to breed him to, it was called a phantom mare. It was actually an artificial process where he had to mount an artificial horse. And he tried once and kind of got distracted and slipped off and didn't quite do it. So they let him try again. And the breeders were giving him all kinds of visual cues and olfactory cues. They waved a ice cube made out of mare's urine underneath his nose to kind of get him in the mood. And the third time he tried and it didn't work. And the head breeder just said, that's it. That's, you know, send him back to his stable. He's done for the day. And they have what they call a three-mount rule. And what was interesting to us about that was just the kind of normalcy that sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't. And, you know, better luck tomorrow.
Did it happen on another day?
It did. It happened the next day.
Yep. Yeah. But only with a mock animal, not with...
Yeah,
is that the way it's usually done? In,
I think nowadays in thoroughbred horse breeding. And
seems to be a bit of a cheat.
Yeah, not thoroughbred.
But yeah, in this instance, these stallions, it was done, was not live cover, but it was done artificially.
Yeah.
And what's interesting also is that they know how to raise a stallion to be a sexually healthy stallion adult. They know that a stallion should not be put with a mean mare for his first sexual experience. Mm-hmm. Young stallions should not have too much sexual experience too early. All of these things predictably will have an adverse effect on his sexual performance and psychological sexual health later in life. And
that goes with the lore about raising young men into sexuality, where the concerned father, this is in Italy undoubtedly, takes him to a pleasant prostitute who knows how to care for young adolescent boys and gentles him along into his first experience.
Well, we think there are many takeaways from the veterinary community, knowledge that's there, that we patients, physicians, parents, just don't have access to because we haven't considered animals to be connected to us sufficiently.
Well, now, that's so interesting. Everything you are talking about and everything you write about in the book is quite interesting. The book, in case those who are listening have lost the title, is Zoobiquity. We haven't yet explained the etymology of that word. But the subtitle, What Animals Can Teach Us About Health and the Science of Healing. But, you know, while we're talking about sexuality, one of the great sayings, it's from Horace, I do believe, and he asserts what he takes to be a universal about human sexuality. He says, Omnes animalum post coitum tristes est. Tristest. All, so it's not just about human sexuality, it's about all mammals, perhaps, or more. What he's saying is all animals are rather depressed after coitus. I wonder if that's true. I wonder if it's visible in your own experience with animals. And what are we to make of that? And I pose that vast question just as we're about to pause for an update on the evening's news. And for that, to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And returning to Barbara Natterson Horowitz, MD, a cardiologist and psychiatrist in training. She works at the UCLA Cardiac Arrhythmia Center and is also a cardiac consultant for the Los Angeles Zoo. And that's one of the ways in which you got started with this special interest, as conveyed in this fine book, Zoobiquity. Catherine Bowers teaches writing at UCLA and has written and edited fiction and nonfiction. Do you have any novels to your credit?
Not that are published. So maybe one away in a drawer. Somewhere.
They're drawer novels, yeah. back to old Horace in the 2nd century AD, I think. And I love the Latin. Omnes animalum post coitum tristus est. All animals are sad after coitus, after a sexual encounter. Is there any reason to think that's really true? Is it true of human beings?
Well, the question is a really good one and opens up a broader question, is do animals experience pleasure with sex?
So I would like to believe they do.
Well, we think that they do, and we talk about that in the book. But certainly when I was kind of coming up as a kid, I was taught about the birds and the bees, and my parents could talk about sex in a way that was very clinical, didn't seem very sexy at all. And somehow I had the idea that we humans have sex to have babies, but also for pleasure, and that animals do it to procreate. Well, it turns out there's lots of non-reproductive sexual behavior.
Oh, Lord, yes.
In the wild. Lots of masturbation. Yeah. Daddy long legs who, you know, rub their genitals with thread, and birds that masturbate with clumps of mud and grass, and lots of same sexual activity.
Homosexual.
Lots of it. They're all male orgies involving giraffes and orcas and manatees. Yeah. That's very, very common.
And lots of heterosexual activity, almost as a way of saying hello. It varies with different species. The bonobo have got a lot of attention for that recently. A species of ape quite closely related to the chimpanzee, and even more closely related to us in DNA than are the chimps. And they do it all day long, more or less.
They seem to do it both as sort of a social bonding exercise and to make up after a fight. And same sex and heterosexual sex also.
So what are we to make of all of that?
Well, it certainly is first of all, just interesting to know about. But I think there are some important takeaways for human sexuality. First of all, let's ask the question, is orgasm uniquely human? Well, it turns out if you talk to animal experts, wildlife specialists who have observed animals over long periods of time, many species of animal exhibit behaviors at the end of coitus that looks a lot like orgasm in humans. For example, crickets, tortoises, and horses exhibit a jerking behavior and in some cases a kind of depressed demeanor.
Sometimes an open mouth, sort of frozen stance at the end.
So it becomes very likely even or definitely possible that their experience of ejaculation is comparable to what a human feels, but, you know, in a different
way. And for those higher animals, ejaculation works the same as it does in the human male, the tumescence, detumescence.
Exactly. Yes. I mean,
Of the experience.
Yeah. I mean, you know, evolution is not just about a skeleton that you see in a museum. I mean, every aspect of our bodies and our minds has evolved through natural selection, and that includes our sexuality. And so when it comes to male sexual function, yes, all human males have descended from common, you know, mammalian ancestral ejaculators, and the physiology is the same. It's preserved.
As well it should be.
Why wouldn't it be?
Going into another area of pathology, or rather going more broadly into all pathologies, as a physician, can you really assert by now that that humans can profit from a closer study of animal disease? Indeed, does the dialogue between veterinarian and allopathic physician pay off in human utility?
There are many takeaways that could benefit human patients right now, today, if physicians and veterinarians had greater conversations and collaboration.
There are potential benefits, but they're not yet realized, you say.
Well, some of them are realized, even now. Obesity is a very good example.
Ah.
We're in the middle of an obesity epidemic, but it turns out there are a number of wild obesity epidemics as well. And, of course, our dogs and cats are getting fatter and fatter. So what can we learn about this? All right, when I have a patient who's overweight or even obese, what do I say to her? We talk. I say, you know what, Mrs. Smith, you need to cut back on the carbs. You need to get out and exercise. It's all about her. And you know what? I do say those things, and sometimes those things work, but you know what? Very often they don't work. But it's about her, the individual. If a wildlife veterinarian sees a group of whales or rats or marmots getting fatter, what does he or she do? They look at the environment. They say, what is happening in the environment to contribute to the fattening of these
animals? Categorize a fat whale. They're so big. How do you tell when they're fat?
Well, we talked to someone who runs whale boat captain who runs whale watching tours off the coast of California, and he said over the past 25 years he's seen a massive change in the blue whale population off California, and it's mainly because the krill that they feed on has become more and more abundant. So he said he's seen them go from very prominent backbones to kind of looking
so
fat.
So the whales have become hogs, as it were.
Yeah.
Is that a good general rule that adiposity increases with the availability of food?
Yeah, we learned, you know, I guess I had this idea. Well, you know, in nature, animals eat until they're sated and then they stop.
Yeah. They have a nutritional wisdom that lets them know exactly how much to eat to remain
lean
and healthy.
We do assume that, don't we?
Well, we definitely assume that. But we interviewed a very prominent veterinary nutritionist, and he told us quite the opposite is true, that across all species, as far as he knows, animals seem to be hardwired to overconsume when they have access, because in nature,
to store up.
Right. Scarcity is part of the picture, too.
Yeah.
So I thought that was fascinating. It's not just me who can't resist the M&Ms if they're sitting on a dish within arm's reach.
There are some wonderful narratives in this book, particular adventures you've had with particular animals. Let's just choose some of those and tell those stories.
Well, we had a really fun trip up to Monterey, California, where we visited a group of sea otters and a woman who observes them and knows a lot about them named Gina Bentall. And off the coast, this particular area is a place that otter researchers call the Triangle of Death. And it's not a very safe place to go. There are great white sharks. There isn't a lot of kelp underneath for animals to hide in. There's riptides that are really dangerous. And so most of the otters don't go there. Male sea otters won't go there. Female sea otters won't go there. Baby sea otters, of course, don't go there. But there is one group of sea otter that will go there, and those are the adolescent males, the daredevils of the otter world. And what this story helped us see is that risk-taking, sensation-seeking that we see in human teens at certain ages of their adolescence can also be seen in other animals.
Are they showing off for the adolescent females?
Ah, that's an interesting question. We didn't actually look into that specifically, but there does seem to be a shared neurobiology or some shared urge that at that particular age helps propel them from their parental nests and dens and from their parents' side. That's actually protective for them.
And in a sad parallel, because of risk-taking and sensation-seeking in human teenagers, we see a lot of accidental injury and death. And it turns out in animals as well, during that adolescent transitional period, they're big enough to be on their own, but they lack the experience. And so they too can fall, you know, they can be preyed upon and they can die. So they have higher rates of death as well. Although most of them do go on and survive and leave the triangle of death and grow up.
And we saw some interesting examples of animal adults helping these adolescent and younger animals learn what their possible dangers are. So there's something that animals do, birds and otters, I think, might do it. It's something called mobbing, where they will move toward their predator en masse, a whole group of animals, sometimes squawking, making a loud noise, and it lets the younger members learn who their predator is and also how to get away from it.
Does one assume full consciousness for the higher animals whom we know so well but whom we don't know at all, because we can ask them anything we want and we can never get an answer? We assume that horses have sensibility, that they think, they experience, they have emotions. We always assume the same about our dogs and cats, because we certainly anthropomorphize there. Dealing with a lab rat, you still in the are rodents mammals? Yes, they are. Mm-hmm. It's still in the mammalian category, but somehow you think they're more instinctively organized, with less will, less consciousness, less sense of self. Mm-hmm. If you get down to a frog in a pond, or if you get down to an ant that you see scurrying across the floor, when it comes to the ant, you don't attribute any awareness of antness to the ant, do you?
Well, one way to get at that question, which is so interesting, is to look at mental illness, what we call mental illness in ourselves, and say, well, are there correlates to that in animals? And we've talked a little bit about sexual dysfunction and depression, but it turns out there are interesting parallels in animals that you wouldn't expect, that are not so connected, not so closely related to us evolutionarily. So, for example, self-injury. When one of the methodologies that we had was that if I saw a human patient at the UCLA with a problem, we'd look for it in animals. And I saw a woman came into my clinic one day. She had palpitations. Her heart was racing. And while I was listening to her heart, I noticed that on the inside of her left forearm, she had horizontal lines.
She's a cutter.
Correct. So Catherine and I went and we said, well, gee, do animals self-injure?
What could seem more human than that? Inflicting injury on your own body.
And it turned out that, yes, indeed they do, and many kinds of animals do, from birds. There are parrots, for example, who pluck out their feathers when they're stressed, and some peck at their skin until they bleed. And there are horses.
You have a horse who bites his rear end.
Mm-hmm. They're called flank biters.
Flank biters.
This can happen in stables and areas where horses live in isolation.
What do you think is going on at that point?
Well, horses are herd animals. They evolved to live in groups. Yeah. And what people who have flank biting horses have discovered is that if they return that self-injuring horse to the herd, sometimes those behaviors will go away. Something else they try is giving them another animal companion. So sometimes they'll place a little chicken or a goat in with that self-injuring animal, and that will calm them down enough so that they stop biting themselves.
And this is exactly the kind of information that we think should come over to the human side, so that parents and psychotherapists and teachers know about this. But as long as it's siloed in the veterinary and animal world, we don't have access to it.
Are you attributing to these animals miserable loneliness as somehow the beginning of or the precondition for self-injury?
Miserable loneliness is an overstatement. What we feel is that stress is a part of life, whether you live in a home or whether you live in the wild. And there are people who have argued very effectively that wildlife could be, that is, life in the wild, could be more stressful than under certain conditions of human stewardship. What we think is that self-injury is a form of self-soothing, kind of gone wild. So that all of us, you know, do little things. We touch ourselves, we twirl our hair, maybe pick at our skin to kind of calm ourselves throughout the day. Some of these behaviors have their origin in grooming. You know, dogs lick themselves, for example. But when a dog gets very stressed out, sometimes it licks and licks and over-licks. It over-grooms until the fur comes out and the skin breaks and bleeds. So we think that stress, when stress gets dialed up, these behaviors, these grooming behaviors, get amplified, and they turn into self-injury.
We are late for a round of commercials. You are keeping me from the proper performance of my duties, since I'm here as a commercials cop. So we pause for a quick round of those, and then directly back to Barbara Natterson-Horowitz and Catherine Bowers. And we will at last dispel the mystery of the etymology of the word zubiquity. Just how that word was coined and what it ultimately means will be disclosed after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And returning to the authors of Zubiquity, Barbara Natterson-Horowitz and Catherine Bauer, explain it. Zoos refers to zoology or zoology. Ubiquity is an interesting and a good word. How do you define ubiquity?
Well, as we've been saying, we're trying to bring together two cultures, animal medicine and human medicine. So Barbara and I had been working together for a few months, finding these many correlations between ourselves and other animals medically and behaviorally and socially. And we wanted a word to describe what we were seeing. And there wasn't really one as we looked in the literature. So we decided to come up with our own. And we combined, as you say, the Greek word for animal, zo, and the Latin word for everywhere. And we came up with ubiquity.
Ubiquity is to be everywhere. Mm-hmm. Or being everywhere.
Yeah, and I kind of like to think of it as seeing ourselves and other animals and other animals in ourselves.
And one important element of zubiquity is it's not just animals in the here and now, because evolutionary biology is a field that really belongs in the clinical setting with physicians. Physicians should embrace evolutionary biology and use it in the practice of medicine. So we look at animals who are living now and also ancient animals. We have a section on cancer in dinosaurs, for example, and other diseases, infections, gout, arthritis that affected dinosaurs and other ancient animals.
How can we know that about dinosaurs? All we have are the skeletons.
Right, and that's a limitation. We can only make diagnoses using bones. And so that's why actually the diagnoses that I mentioned, gout and arthritis, these are have been made using x-rays and in some instances MRI. We don't have soft tissue. On the other hand,
so how do we know about the presence of cancer?
There are certain forms of cancer that have bony manifestations, bone cancers, metastatic cancers, and some benign tumors.
Mm-hmm. So the woes of mankind have always been there. Before mankind evolved.
Well, one of the takeaways we hope for patients is to recognize that disease is ancient, it's species spanning. We do lots of things to increase our risk of disease, cancer, for example, smoking, drinking, all kinds of problems. However, if you strip all those bad habits away, you would still have disease. Sometimes we have this kind of fantasy that in the wild, in the past, there was not disease, everything was perfect. It was a Garden of Eden, quite untrue.
That's the Rousseauian vision of the paradise before society.
And the problem is that for patients, I mean, there are definitely things we can do to reduce our risk of cancer, for example. There's all kinds of excellent preventive advice. But sometimes patients confuse the ability to reduce risk with causing cancer if they do have a diagnosis.
Or avoiding risk altogether, that if I just do this and I do this and I do this and I avoid this, this, and this, then I'm never going to get sick. And this is just I actually find it comforting to look at it this way and not feel like everything is brought on by our own human society or behaviors.
Well, comforting to know that the moving finger writes, and sooner or later it writes our doom.
Mm-hmm. Right. And there is there's a lot of you wouldn't think it, but even with a disease, a diagnosis like cancer, there can be a lot of self-blame, a lot of shame, and even stigma. And knowing that these diseases are ancient and not unique to humans could help with that.
Medicine interests everybody, not only physicians, and it interests all of them because they are all, if they have any consciousness at all worthy of being designated human, they're aware of death. And death is the ultimate burden in life. it becomes more and more so as you grow older. The one remembers as a child of 8 or 10 or 12, you suddenly began to think about death and were very burdened by the horrible realization that it will happen to your parents and ultimately will happen to you. Yet we live with that and we accommodate to that. One of the great speculations about our us in relation to other animals, higher animals, is do they know that they're going to die?
I don't know exactly how to answer that because I don't think we can know what any individual animal is thinking.
Well, they have members of their group falling dead.
Yes.
So something – they know that some – if they know anything, they know that something changes.
Exactly.
Well, there are two ways that I would want to answer that. First is one of the questions we asked are, do animals ever commit suicide? Okay. So, mm-hmm. Again, we thought, my God, that's uniquely human because it doesn't make any sense from an evolutionary standpoint. But, again, we scratch the surface and we find out, let's start with insects. Entomologists have been describing a form of insect suicide that's driven by parasitic infection. So a parasite infects a cricket or a grasshopper. Those are two examples. And the worm then injects a chemical into the cricket's brain that induces the cricket to jump off the ledge into water. And he can't swim, so he drowns. And that allows the worm to get out of the cricket's body and continue its life cycle. So that is indeed a form of insect suicide. Mm-hmm. Interesting, very recently.
It's also insect murder.
Well, exactly. It's either homicide or suicide, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But interesting, there's recently some interesting theories about toxoplasmosis in humans, toxo infection in humans changing mm-hmm. behaviors. And so there are these interesting parallels. And the other point about
I got to stop you for a moment. Toxoplasmosis, did you say? The man who uses the Twinkie defense to account for a murder. The Twinkies drove him crazy. That's happened, you know. Various foods or alcohol or simply appealing to being drunk so that I became another person. I didn't know what I was doing. That wasn't me.
Right. And that is actually the Twinkie defense. I mean, the idea that our neurobiology is responsible for our behavior, that's certainly problematic ethically, legally. It's an interesting question. But in the case of parasitic infection, where there's actual – we can document the changes to the brain, the disinhibition that occurs with certain infections in humans, we describe that. And it happens in animals too. There are certain rodents when they're infected by toxoplasmosis, they actually approach cats and they make themselves ready prey.
Yeah. They lose their fear of cats and the smell of cats, and so they approach the cat.
But in terms of animals, there is a reflex, a neurological reflex that many animals have when death is imminent that gives them a kind of last-ditch potential for survival. And when, for example, they're very stressed, you would think that fight and flight is the response. The heartbeat should speed up so that the animal can swim away or fight. But once in a while, in the throes of great danger, the opposite happens. The heart rate goes very, very low. And the reason it seems to do that in fish and in mammals and even in us is that it makes the animal very still and silent. Mm-hmm. And potentially that animal can evade the predator.
But you haven't answered my question 5 minutes ago. Mm-hmm. Do our near neighbor animals understand and have a knowledge of death?
I don't know. I would say they do seem to react to their kin dying, and they will run away when threatened. So to me, that means they have a sense of something, whether mm-hmm. it's a looming mechanism going on that's making them sense danger and try to evade it, or whether it's a complete knowledge that their days might be numbered or their hours might
do
be numbered.
Do we ever observe apes weeping?
We read a naturalist describing some what looked like mourning behavior in a number of animals. Actually, interestingly, in sea lions, sea lions let out a kind of a squeal that sounds like a mourning – I forget
a
the
whale,
term.
Kind of like
it was a whale. Yeah. Exactly. When a sea lion mother was heard to be emitting this when she saw her pups eaten by an orca. And again, we have to speculate. We don't have language, and we don't know what their concept of permanence is, because permanence mm-hmm. and death are what really our consciousness is about. But the behavior.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if we did have language that we could share with at least some of the higher apes? there was a time, as you well know, that the psychologists were, and many linguists as well, were rather convinced that we might be able to achieve that. We can teach languages, at least to chimpanzees and gorillas, and thus open up a line of communication which we've never had before. It seems to have been as much an illusion or delusion as an achievement, though for a while we thought we had linguistic apes. Washoe, the famous ape from Nevada, and Nim Chimpsky, right, named for Noam Chomsky, whose trainer was convinced he had taught him language and then thought otherwise after some 10 years of bragging that he had a linguistic chimp and confessed that he had been mistaken and wrote a book taking it all back. And now we're kind of generally convinced there is no teachable form of real language. There may be a few signs that can be comprehended, but no even high chimp can possibly manage syntax and generalization and logical structure and utterance more than three words long. Give me banana, maybe, but that's about it. We return shortly. When we come back, we're going to turn into veterinarians. From all of this, there must be some practical advice that you would give to people at home with dogs and cats and whatever other, and birds, I suppose. One can derive something about animal health as well as human health from these close investigations. We'll be directly back then after the update on this evening's news from Paula Cooper.
It's Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg from the Allstate Studios in Chicago on 720 WGN.
Our guests tonight have been and continue to be for the second hour Barbara Natterson Horowitz, MD, and Catherine Bowers. There's no particular alphabetic designation after your name to indicate that you're a very well-equipped and highly specialized writer and science writer. And their book, Zubiquity, What Animals Can Teach Us About Health and the Science of Healing, is just recently published by Alfred A. Knopf and Company. And before we go back, it is time to invite telephone calls. We'll let them accumulate for just a bit, and after the next commercial break, we'll go directly to the phones. The number, as ever, 312-591-7200. 312-591-7200. And now we've got the email working again, I think. And therefore, if you want to reach us via email, this is particularly relevant for our distant listeners listening over the Internet elsewhere, up in Saskatchewan, down in Yucatan or on other continents, and the email address, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Extension 720 is one word, at WGNradio.com, or for phones, 312-591-7200. If you want to be heard, get your calls in now, if you don't mind waiting just a bit, with question or, for that matter, with comment. It does seem to me that you ought to be able to, we've had a resident veterinarian on this program. We did a wonderful little program giving advice on a weekend for a half an hour or an hour or more about the health of animals. What are basic guides to animal health that you've acquired? You both also own and have dogs at home. But from all of your experience with veterinarians and with looking at so many different breeds of animals, what can one derive from that that is of direct valued applicability in the ordinary American home?
Right. Well, speaking first as a physician and second as a dog owner, I definitely have become a better physician working with veterinarians. Their perspective is broader. And I mean, I can't generalize. Every veterinarian is different. But I think in many ways, veterinarians have a harder job than we human doctors do. They first of all, they have to be pediatricians and geriatricians. They often take care of mammals and reptiles. Yeah.
And you can't say to the patient, where does it hurt?
Exactly. In fact, actually, veterinarians have a little well, unfortunately, I think physicians truthfully have not really considered veterinarians as clinical peers. And that's wrong because they have a tremendous amount to teach us. But the flip side is that the veterinarians have a kind of inside joke about physicians. Their joke is, what do you call a veterinarian who only takes care of one species?
Huh.
That would be a physician.
Yeah.
So, Yeah, I mean, just over the course of writing the book and watching my children grow up and watching my dogs grow up, I see all kinds of commonalities. For example, watching how when we were training our dogs to just behave properly, using positive reinforcement, using rewards, using soft voices, there are direct parallels to parenting that really affected watching a very seasoned dog trainer teach our dogs helped me, frankly, with some aspects of parenting.
Mm-hmm. And also just the idea of thinking beyond our verbal abilities to communicate with other people and other species, looking at body language, gait, eye gaze, other things that might communicate sometimes even more than what someone is saying with their words.
But what are the immediate and practical guidelines for keeping your dog or cat or whatever healthy? What should one watch for when there is potential trouble around? What kind of nutrition, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, one point that we learned that, you know, animals can be sentinels for human health. Sentinels, kind of a canary in the coal mine. And what that means is that, you know, in homes, for example, where there's toxic exposures, you know, animals are smaller. Our dogs are smaller. They weigh less. They're closer to the ground. So sometimes if there's a hazardous chemical, for example, in a home or some substance, sometimes the animals get sick before we do. And so we need to keep a close eye on our animals because their health is very important, but also because they can signal a risk to our children and to ourselves. And that's true, by the way, not only for companion animals, but also for wildlife. There were a group of beluga whales off the coast of Canada about 25 years ago that started washing ashore. They were dead, and they had cancers all over their body. I mean, breast cancers and colon cancers. And it turned out there was an aluminum smelting facility that was contaminating the waters. And the women that were living in the regions there also had a parallel epidemic of breast cancers, et cetera. So keeping an eye on animal health can help us identify toxic and, in some cases, infectious exposures that could affect our health.
Yeah. In California, there's problems with lead toxicity in some of the older paint in the soil in areas that have been populated for a while. And California condors also have problems with lead toxicity. And we've been part of some groups that have brought together physicians and veterinarians on both sides of that lead issue to try to talk about health.
You've actually got some sort of organization going now, haven't you?
Well, it's not an organization. Zubiquity is a book that we've written, but we also have hosted something called the Zubiquity Conference. Yeah. And we actually brought together UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine, some of their senior faculty. We brought them to UCLA to have a conference with the UCLA School of Medicine senior faculty. So we had a very esteemed veterinary cardiologist discussing a case of heart failure in a cat, and then a very esteemed human cardiologist discussing the same kind of heart failure in a human. We had the veterinarian comment on the human case. We had the human physician comment on the veterinary case. And it was a wonderful meeting of minds and a shaking of hands across the species divide. And we did it for, we had heart failure, we had cancer, we had a brain tumor in a high school principal and in a Rhodesian Ridgeback, a dog. And we did the same thing. Then the whole group, half veterinarians and half physicians, got on buses and we went to the freeway in LA and we went to the Los Angeles Zoo. And there, the veterinarians at the LA Zoo hosted us and we all went on walk rounds together. That is, we heard about animal patients with the same problems as humans have. And the idea was to really create bonds, connections, and we think it was very successful. We're actually going to do it again this year, looking at infertility, breast cancer, bullying.
Do you think this sort of experience makes a better position out of a physician?
For sure. I teach a course now at the medical school. I teach a number of courses at UCLA Medical School, but I've started teaching a course on comparative cardiology. And now I'm teaching medical students, you know, the basics, EKG and physical diagnosis, but we also look at animals with the same problems. And I sometimes have veterinary students come and meet the medical students so that these are clinical peers. We are all really in the same field and we need to build connections even at the student level. So, yes.
With that, let's pause, take care of some commercials, and then we'll go directly to the phones. The lines are open. 312-591-7200 is the number. Get your calls in right now if you want to be heard, whether you're posing a question or, for that matter, offering a report or some wisdom of your own. 312-591-7200 for email extension 720 at wgnradio.com. and directly back after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we, with quick alacrity, we return to our conversation with Barbara Natterson-Horowitz, MD, and Catherine Bowers, who are the co-authors of the book Zoobiquity, What Animals Can Teach Us About Health and the Science of Healing. And we'll go directly to the phones. 312-591-7200. And the first caller is David. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. Yes, this is David from North Riverside.
Yes, sir. We're waiting for you. Go ahead.
Yes, I've heard that sharks and emus have no known diseases, and I'd like to know if that's true. And if so, what do we know about their physiology that makes them so disease-resistant?
Sharks and emus incapable of catching a disease? Is that true?
Well, let's start with sharks. We had heard, and I think it's widely believed, that sharks don't get cancer. We learned that that is not true at all. There are many sharks who have had many forms of cancer that we learned about. So that is not true. I can't speak to emus, but I will say I think it's very, very unlikely that any animal is truly disease-free. It doesn't make sense, and it would be extremely surprising. Having said that, I'm not an emu expert.
I would think so as well. What do we know about the correlates of longevity? We know that whales live a very long time. They're not the most long-lived of all animals, are they?
No, I mean, there are some animals that are very long-lived.
Tortoises sometimes can go to 200 years or more.
Mm-hmm. I think Lonely George just passed. Didn't he?
Lonesome George.
Lonesome George. Yeah.
Yeah. Where was he?
In the Galapagos.
That's what I thought. Yeah. That one, yeah. At what age? Do you remember?
100 and something.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Back to the phones. 312-591-7200. And next up is Dave. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yes. I was just wondering if there's any animals that, like, they say we drink too much coffee, you're going to get cancer. Is there anything like an animal, if they eat too much, going to end up getting cancer?
Well, the cancer question is an interesting one. We know that animals, when they become obese, when they overeat and get obese or even overweight, they do suffer from the same health complications that we have, diabetes, hypertension, and premature death, and in some cases probably cancer. I'm talking about companion animals, by the way.
There's also the idea that we found dinosaur cancer, evidence in the fossil record of dinosaur cancer, and ancient Earth was not a pristine area. There was toxic spew from volcanoes. There were cycads and conifers, which are the food that certain dinosaurs ate that are really high in carcinogens. So,
they get the cancer then, eating too much of that stuff.
I couldn't understand what...
We're having a little trouble, sir, understanding you. Would you say that again, please?
Doctors say, well, you drink too much coffee, you're going to get cancer. Or you eat, what they do to rats, too much coke, you're going to get cancer.
Well, there's certainly things that human beings can do that dial up those risks. That's true.
And with that, we'll go quickly to another caller. There's room on the board. If you want to join us, now's the time to make your move. In fact, I want some of our good friends to get in there with their interesting comments and or questions. 312-591-7200, the number. And next up is Mark. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, sir. I think you've got the radio on, which is going to complicate matters just a bit.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't have anything in the background there, so I got bored. my question is there any kind of a website or information that I can go to find out an area, let's say, where there is an alarming rate of death in animals and that may correlate to a human? My motivation behind that is I'm in the process of moving, and it would be nice to know something like that before you make the full plunge into purchasing a house.
I don't know if there's anything super comprehensive down to that kind of level that you're looking for, but there's an excellent website called the Canary Database.
Oops. Now we seem to have lost the caller.
Okay. Well, it's called the Canary anyway. Database, and it tracks epidemics of all kinds of things, from toxic exposures to infection in human and animal populations.
And let's go next. You understand we're still on a kind of sort of a shakedown cruise with these new studios, and strange noises suddenly appear. The one just talks through them, if at all possible. So, next up, I guess, would be, I'm not sure who it would be, and somebody's come to our aid here. The silence you hear is the confusion of the talk show host. I think what we'll do right now is, I think I'll just talk to my producer,
Tom,
who's trying to tell me something.
Tom.
Why don't you plug him in? Good evening, Tom. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Please go ahead.
I've got kind of a two-part question, if I could. The first has to do with you hear some people, regardless of what your feelings are among humans, some people who will advocate that homosexuality is natural because it happens in nature, that there are animals where homosexuality will happen. And I know from, like, an agricultural background, sometimes when animals are in estrus, they may mount each other, but it's not really a homosexual behavior. I'm curious to hear, first of all, if it really does occur in nature in the same way that you would expect it in humans. And the second part of the question is, I have also heard that there are unattractive human behaviors that occur in nature among animals. For example, outright murder, rape, and other unhealthy human attributes. And I'm curious, is it really possible to attribute those type of, for lack of a better term, crimes in animals to human behavior? If it makes sense what I'm trying to ask.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question. So if you look at animal sexual behavior, and let's look at animals in the wild, there are many, many examples of same sexual behavior and many forms of it that we see in a wide spectrum of animals. And, you know, one of the points we make is that, you know, if one's definition of natural is something that happens in nature, then yes, same sexual activity does happen in nature, and it happens a lot. You know, we can't speak to preference. That's more complicated. But in terms of activity, yeah, absolutely. The second part of your question.
I'm sorry. Do you see it more, though, if you have a lack of one gender versus another, so that it's not so much that it's something that's happening as a preference? It's happening for lack of an outlet for the sexuality.
Right. Sexuality, yeah. There seem to be a number of purposes, functions of variety of forms of sexual behavior in the wild, including in some group. There are groups of young mammals who engage in same sexual behavior as a kind of bonding, as a kind of a determination of the social hierarchy. So there are so many varieties that I can't make a single statement in response to your question. But in terms of rape, in terms of incest, in terms of necrophilia, those kinds of sexual behaviors also happen in the wild. And so what I think we can take away from this is to say, you know, we as humans can't turn to nature to determine what we think is right and wrong. But we should be aware that there's a spectrum of all of these behaviors, you know, in the wild.
With that, sir, we thank you for the call. And a word to our listeners. Let's get some more calls in here. It occurs to me something that would be quite useful and quite interesting would be reports from your own home about your own animals and how they behave and what you attribute to them, what you think is going on in their lives, in their consciousness. So you could brag about your animals or confess your sheer confusion and frustration with those animals in further conversation. For any such purpose, the number 312-591-7200. We would like you to get those calls in quickly. We need for a few more good calls. 312-591-7200. We look forward to hearing from you as we pause for the update on the news from Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Barbara Natterson Horowitz and Catherine Bowers, and drawing from but not doing full justice to this rich new book of theirs, Zoobiquity, What Animals Can Teach Us About Health and the Science of Healing. That's just published by Alfred A. Knopf and Company. Here is an email from a listener who says, "My coworker and I enjoy your show, especially tonight's topic, particularly the psychology of animals. We work at a 24-hour crisis hotline in Lake County. Our question, when animals' mates die, does the surviving partner become depressed or ill and have the possibility of passing away soon after they lose their partner, like we see in humans at times?"
Well, we've heard stories from pet owners and others about a kind of mourning behavior and a withdrawal from eating and from normal activity, and in some cases, yes, dying. But these are anecdotal reports that we've heard.
Mm-hmm. And from veterinarians also.
Yeah. Which tells us that the answer to the question I was pressing earlier is yes, of course, animals are aware of death and know the difference once it occurs. We go back to the phones now, 312-591-7200, and Brooke is our next caller. Good evening. You are on the air. Hello,
hi.
Are you there?
Yes. I watched a program a few months back and was dealing more with the language of animals within their species and less in teaching gorilla sign language. It had more to do with dolphins and whales and their form of communication. And I hadn't seen anything about it since. I wondered if they had run into that in regards, well, to seeing kind of that awareness of death and mortality, the permanence of things within their perceived language. They'd have come across any of those studies that were done, and if they had any thoughts on that. If that made sense.
Yeah. Well, we've come across a lot of different examples of how animals communicate with each other that don't involve the same kinds of words that we humans use. Songbirds, for example, have wide ranges of different tunes that they sing to each other at different times of the year. There's even some talk of accents and even stuttering in certain songbirds that ornithologists are looking into. Like you say, dolphins and whales have very complicated vocalizing and other ways of communicating with each other, and so do elephants. There's been a lot of work on that. In terms of how it relates to their knowledge or perception of death, that I haven't seen any specific work on.
And we thank you, ma'am, for the call. We'll go next to Rick at 312-591-7200. And good evening, Rick.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I have four cats at home, and I've heard in the past that cats don't have any type of long-term type memory, but yet I'm seeing, at least my experience, that they seem to remember things. For example, I clipped their claws, and it's like I got one cat that when he sees me grab the clippers will come running up to me because he or she enjoys having them done. Yet I had another one that had a bad experience at one time and tried running away from me, had caught her, clipped the nails, and now every time I bring out the clips, she'll go run away and hide. And there are other things that I've seen where, they seem to remember things and they act upon it. So, do they have a long-type range memory or not?
Right. Well, remember, we're not veterinarians. But in the course of studying and researching the book, we encountered a lot of interesting information about animal memory. And, animals of different species need to remember different kinds of things. And some of them have remarkable memory feats. For example, squirrels can remember where they've placed hundreds, if not thousands, of acorns within an area of a field. And they can accurately retrieve each one, a kind of like that game concentration you play with your kids. I mean, they just absolutely can remember that. And as well as true with birds who can navigate and recall where they seem to have been, etc. It's also interesting you mention a cat who seems to remember a trauma. There's interesting research that's looking at whether post-traumatic stress disorder exists in dogs and cats.
Mm-hmm. And also the idea that groups of animals aren't groups of clones. They're not all going to act in exactly the same way under the same circumstances. So you might have one that's more bold or more shy, or one who seems to remember something more in a way that a human might remember something, and one that seems a little bit different. And I think that's a useful thing to remember, too. Animals.
Well,
go ahead.
Yeah, the one thing with the one that runs away is kind of funny, because she learned fairly quickly that if my wife and I are anywhere near each other, she will run away and not want to be in the same room with us. But yet if I'm in the room alone with her, or if my wife's alone with her, she'll have no time or no problem coming up to you and, you know, rubbing up against you. You'd be able to pick her up in that. But if we're both together, she'll disappear and want no part of us. So she knows that it's at that point that, oh, we may be getting the clippers out. So it's kind of funny. And I have another cat that if anyone in the house is sick or getting sick, it's like she'll pick that up and she'll actually come and save you. Or if you go to lay down because you're not feeling well, she'll go up on the bed and stay with you all that time period and just be near you always until you've gotten better.
Mm.
So we kind of call her the nurse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, various personalities.
Yeah. Thank you, sir. Glad to have heard from you. We move on. I want to read you an email that's come from an old friend, Mark, who lives in Nashville, Tennessee. And he says, none of the equipment works properly, nor does the host work properly. Now I've got it all. Here we go. At the Memphis Zoo once, I visited the primate house. The big male gorilla sat there alone. I was the only visitor. Only the glass plastic big window separated us. We stared at one another. I was at a proper distance, and I wondered what he was thinking. As he looked into my eyes, suddenly he charged toward me and struck his elbow fiercely against the window, a blow no doubt intended for me. Of course, I departed in some fright, but also with a sense of compassion for the gorilla. What was he thinking? Why did he charge and hit the cage window?
It's a wonderful question. And one of the opportunities we had in writing this book was to move beyond the caution to not anthropomorphize. Again, you know, I have to say, before writing this book, if I had heard that, I might have hesitated to say that his intention was, you know, violent harm to our caller. And yet it seems frankly obvious that this was experienced by this gorilla as this man was as a threat, and he was, you know, wanted to probably harm him.
It's conceivable that if you were a caged gorilla, you might be angry most of the time just for being in the cage, and might somehow be angry at any humans who came too close, even on the other side of the window.
This, again, I think gets to stress, isolation, and boredom, and the various ways that animals are kept and how we treat the animals in our care. Zoos, as you probably know, have come a long way in the last 50 years. They used to exist solely for human entertainment, and now their main mission is education and conservation. And I think most of the zoos that you go to in North America and Europe and many other parts of the world really take those missions seriously and the care of their animals very seriously, too.
And in fact, one very important note about zoos in North America, AZA zoos, is that, you know, they do a lot of species survival. There's something called the species survival plans. And many of the endangered species, what they call the charismatic megafauna, you know, the big cats and the elephants, mm-hmm. the animals that we love, are facing extinction. It's no longer hypothetical. And, you know, of course, we're trying to reverse the problems that are leading to extinction, but these are very challenging problems, deforestation and habitat disruption. So many of these animals, if they survive at all, will survive under some form of human stewardship. And so the responsibility on us is to create environments which are healthy for animals, and hopefully, ultimately, we can look to some reintroduction. But in the interim, zoos and other organizations are very focused on conservation and education.
With that, we pause the last round of commercials and then directly back to the phones. I see some room available again on the phone board. So if you've been trying to reach us and not getting through, make another quick try. Somebody will get through at 591 7200. Two lines available at this instant, and we shall return directly after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we will go directly back to the phones. The next caller is Gene, and if somebody would tell me where Gene is located, one thing we need to work out is the signaling of the calls. I think she is number one. So, let's try that. Good evening, Gene. Hello, are you there?
Hello, yes, I am.
Please proceed.
Hi, this is Gene. Hi, I can't hear anything.
Well, you can't hear anything because we're waiting for you to talk.
Oh, sorry. Oh, okay, thank you. Yes, my friend had two dogs. They were both over like 10 years, and they were together a long time. She lost one of them. She had to put them one down. And the other one showed such grief. This dog would not eat for a week, and she like really moped around. And so this really goes along with what the subject matter of today is.
Yeah,
that is my comment.
What your story reminds me of is how, as a physician, watching how veterinarians deal with animals when they're sick and even animals when they're dying, there's some of the most humanistic medicine that's practiced is practiced by doctors whose patients aren't human, because veterinarians seem to understand toward the end of life that quality of life is important over quantity, something that physicians sometimes forget.
We thank you, ma'am. Glad to have heard from you. Next up is Barbara. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, hi. I didn't know I'm on. Okay. There are two crows that live near my house, which I watch. And I also give a squirrel, I gave a squirrel a piece of toast through a bush where you always put something under for the squirrel. So the crow must have seen it, and the big crow came down, and he tried getting under the bush. Every time he tried to get the toast, the top of the bush would, I guess, hit his back or something. He couldn't reach it. So then he must have tried four or five times, and then he flew away. And about 2 minutes later, the other crow came with him, a smaller crow. There's a big and small one, and the big one like stood in front or got down on the ground in front of the bush, and then the little one went in there and grabbed the bush and the toast, and then they both flew away.
Well, the crow family, they call them corvids, are some of the quote-unquote most intelligent birds you can find, crows and blue jays. And again, judging intelligence by what we humans think of as intelligence. And I'm always interested in how, again, Barbara said something about this earlier, how we think animals can't show empathy. Animals can't do this. Man is the only animal that fill in the blank. And one of these topics is tool use. And you often hear animals don't use tools, but then lo and behold, chimpanzees, orangutans, crows, many other animals use tools. Even there's crabs that can use tools to open their prey. So, it's an interesting story you tell.
Well, I just thought it was very complicated because he had to figure out he couldn't do it, but the smaller one could, and then went back and somehow communicated. And then the big one didn't even try to go at the time they came back. The little one just went in there, and it was amazing. Very impressive.
Yeah.
Thank you, ma'am. Glad to have heard
from
you. And we go next to Mike, I believe, at 312-591-7200. Good evening. Is that Mike?
Yes.
Please go ahead.
Okay.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Okay. Yes, how are you, Milt?
I see that you've got your radio on. That's what's producing the confusion.
Oh, if you give me a second, I'll turn it off.
Sure, we'll just hum a little tune while you do
that. Okay, I will turn it off.
All right. these are the vagaries, the vicissitudes of radio hosting. And with the equipment, superb equipment though it is, still a little confounding and confusing, we're having some special adventures. The second week begins with adventures equal to the adventures of the first week. And are you back at the at the phone? Attaboy.
The question I have is, I was curious from your guests as to whether or not animals with in a similar manner suffer from cataracts like most humans will if they live long enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, there are veterinary ophthalmologists, and there are all kinds of eye problems that befall animals of all kinds. They get foreign objects in their eyes. They get, off the top of my head, again, I'm not a veterinarian, but I believe I've heard about cataracts in some animals.
Would that be also in the wild or only domestic animals?
That's a great question, and I think it's really not completely known. One thing that we have been very fascinated by is to question statements like blank never happens in the wild. The reality is we don't really have a firm sense about what does and what does not happen in the wild. We're dependent on a few naturalists, a few wildlife biologists who, you know, see what they see. So it's a great question I don't have the answer for.
I would like to add one thing, if I may. One of the things I did, because I'm suffering from this, is I searched the New England Journal of Medicine and many other journals, and I couldn't find very much research that was being done within this country to discover the causative factors of cataracts. However, in Europe and in Russia, they have been doing such research, and there's such a simplicity of operations now, put lenses in eyes, and there's a high success rate, and I'm wondering whether there's any relationship between the two.
You're saying relating that to animal
population? Well, that's why I asked the question. I was curious whether it was natural to develop cataracts in animals also, like they claim there is in humans if you live long enough. That's the origin of the focus of the question.
Right. You know, again, I'm not an expert on the eye, but it's one of the questions. It's the type of question that Catherine and I have really enjoyed researching. And so going to veterinary journals and seeing what's in the literature is a great first place to start.
Okay. Thank you.
We thank you, sir, for the call. And up comes Larry, who's going to respond instantly. Good evening, Larry. Well, maybe he won't. Larry, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Why do you take so long responding?
It's first I've heard. First I've heard you call my name.
I see. Well, there's something that tests out whether we've got a continuing problem with the system. I would say we do. Uh-huh. I hope that those in authority around here will take note of that. Meanwhile, do please proceed.
Yes. I just wanted to relate an experience I had some years ago. I had a pet dog, a small Bichon Frise, passed away, and we had it put to sleep at the vet. We brought it home. We buried it under our deck in the backyard. And about a week later, I would say, I was downstairs early in the morning making breakfast, and I heard the dog, which had a very characteristic bark, barking in our garage, attached garage. You could hear it through the wall, through the door. Didn't say anything to my wife, but she told me about a week after that that she had heard the same thing. The day before, so there were two separate instances.
So this is a ghostly dog, is it?
Pardon me?
The ghost of the dog had appeared in your garage.
Well, I guess you could put it that way. Yes.
Well, how would you put it?
I was wondering if your guest had any knowledge of any similar stories that might indicate that an animal might have a spirit that passes on, like.
To try a more parsimonious possibility? Could it not have been another dog in the neighborhood? Barking at some distance?
No doubt about it. It was from the garage, and the garage is an attached garage, and the overhead door was shut. Hadn't been opened yet. Our houses are fairly far apart. They're half-acre lots.
Uh-huh.
We didn't come across anything exactly like that, but I would say that maybe grief can go across species, too, and it's possible that maybe, you know, you were both grieving your dog.
Hmm. Interesting. Mm-hmm.
And, are you suggesting an hallucinatory bark?
I'm just suggesting that we all have, deal with grief in different ways. And,
yeah.
When a pet passes on, you can really miss it.
But I'm afraid, sir, in fact, if you're looking for a true parapsychological reinforcement, you're running into some skepticism here.
Well, there's no doubt I heard it. I heard. I believe my wife, I'm hoping there is a way that a spirit of an animal could pass on to humans does.
You should be in touch with the amazing Randy, who will check it out for you if you know him. I thank you for the call.
I know you're making light of it, but I'm not making light,
but I confess to a certain residual skepticism when I hear stories of this sort. We thank you for the call, by all means. Let me see. Do we have time for one more? Perhaps we do, and that would be... No, I don't know. I have no signals telling me where to go next, so I'll assume I'm not supposed to go anywhere else. And we've only got about 3 minutes left anyway. That gives me time, in fact, to read at least one endorsement of your book. You've got some fine blurbs. And here's one from a colleague at the University of Chicago, Neil Shubin, who's been on this program, one of the great paleontologists of the Western world. He says, if common ancestors with worms, fish, and apes lie in our past, then zubiquity points the way to our future. The connections we share with the rest of life on our planet are a source of beauty and, in Natterson Horowitz and Bauer's luminous new account, the inspiration for an emerging and powerful approach to human health. Zubiquity is a book that explodes barriers and myths, all in the purpose of bettering the human condition. Well, that's a strong endorsement, is it not? And I think Neil is quite right. He, of course, is the author of Your Inner Fish, which we discussed with him when it appeared perhaps about 2 years ago.
A wonderful book.
A very wonderful book. And I agree with him completely. So is yours. It's very well crafted, very well written. The stories are great. And one needs to stress that there's fine narrative here. This isn't just a heavy medical tome, not at all. It is quite the opposite. And you're selling quite well, I gather, around the book marts.
Yes, we are. We're very pleased with the response.
Well,
yes,
good.
Thank you.
Good. Back to UCLA tomorrow to go to work again?
Back to LA.
Yeah.
Back to the human patients. And hopefully occasionally working with the animals. Working with veterinarians has been transformational for me. Mm-hmm. It's changed how I am as a doctor and as a parent. And
We've only got a minute left. How has it affected your practice as a cardiologist?
Well, I think about the diseases in a different way. Certain patients I can actually talk to about the animal version. For example, I have a number of patients who have mitral valve prolapse and a leaky mitral valve. And I tell them about, Cavalier King Charles that have the same problem, about some of the animals at the zoo that have the same problem. And for some patients, it's fascinating. And for others, less so. And the same thing is true with patients who have cancer and who have psychiatric syndromes.
We're almost out of time, but suddenly I'm curious. Has anyone ever attempted, not for experimental purposes, but for therapeutic purposes, actual heart transplants for animals?
Not that I know of therapeutically. I would be surprised if that's happening. There are a few veterinary cardiothoracic surgeons who do open procedures, valve replacements, that sort of surgery. But transplant, I doubt, although I'm not 100%
sure. When the transplant thing was first being developed, they did it with experimental animals. And I think they used dogs in a number of those.
Yes.
That fellow Christian Bernard, is that his name, down in South Africa, did just that. And with that, we do come to the end of the available time. We've got a wonderful program scheduled for tomorrow night, but I don't remember what it is. And no one has put it up on my board. Yes, here it is. Here it is. Oh, yes, of course. We're doing a conversation on healthcare reform with Rosemary Gibson and John Tillman. Obamacare, basically. And are you for it or against it? And will it work or won't it work? And will it impose a tax burden that is bearable or is unbearable? All of that under discussion tomorrow night with two old friends. And with that, we'll wind down completely for the evening. With thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night.